The heart of the fray. Along with the warriors of his battalion, Roran fought his way down off Urabain's outer wall to the streets below. There they paused to regroup. Then he shouted, "To the gate!" and pointed with his hammer. He and several men from Carvajal, including Horst and Delwyn, took the lead as they trotted along the inside of the wall toward the breach the elves had created with their magic. Arrows flitted over their heads as they ran, but none were aimed at them specifically, and he did not hear any of their group take a wound. They encountered dozens of soldiers in the narrow space between the wall and the stone houses. A few paused to fight, but the rest ran, and even those who fought soon retreated down the adjoining alleyways. At first, the savage intensity of slaughter and victory blinded Roran to all else. But when the soldiers they met continued to flee, a sense of unease began to gnaw at his stomach, and he began to look around with greater alertness, searching for anything that seemed different from what it ought to be. Something was wrong. He was sure of it. Galbatorix wouldn't let them give up this easily, he muttered to himself. What? Asked Albrecht, who was next to him. I said Galbatorix wouldn't let them give up this easily. Twisting his head around, Roran shouted to the rest of the battalion, Pin back your ears and look sharp! Galbatorix has a surprise or two in store for us, I wager. We won't let ourselves get caught unawares, though, now will we? Strong hammer! They shouted in return, and pounded their weapons against their shields. All but the elves, that was. Satisfied, he quickened the pace, even as he continued to scan the rooftops. They soon broke out into the rubble-strewn street that led to what had once been the main gate of the city. Now all that was left was a gaping hole several hundred feet wide at the top, with a pile of broken stones at the bottom. Through the gap streamed the Varden and their allies, men, dwarves, urgles, elves and weircats, fighting alongside one another for the first time in history. Arrows rained down on the army as it poured into the city, but the elves' magic stopped the deadly darts before they could cause harm. The same did not hold true for Galbatorix's soldiers. Roran saw a number of them fall to the Varden's archers, although some appeared to have wards that protected them from the arrows. Galbatorix's favourites, he assumed. As his battalion joined the rest of the army, Roran spotted Jormunder riding in the press of warriors. Roran called out greetings, and Jormunder replied in kind and shouted, Once we reach that fountain! He pointed with his sword toward a large, ornate edifice that stood in a courtyard several hundred yards in front of them. Take your men and head off to the right. Clear the southern part of the city, then meet back up with us at the citadel. Roran nodded, exaggerating the movement so Jormunder would see. Sir! He felt safer now that they had the company of other warriors. But still his sense of unease continued. Where are they? He wondered, looking at the mouths of the empty streets. Galbatorix had supposedly gathered the whole of his army in Urabain, but Roran had yet to see evidence of a large force of men. There had been surprisingly few soldiers on the walls, and those who were present had fled far sooner than they should have. He's luring us in, Roran realized with sudden certainty. It's all a play designed to trick us. Catching Jormunder's attention again, he shouted, Something's wrong! Where are the soldiers? Jormunder frowned and turned to speak with King Orin and Queen Islandzadi, who had ridden up to him. Oddly enough, a white raven sat on Islandzadi's left shoulder, his claws hooked into her corselet of golden armour. And still the Varden continued to march deeper and deeper into Urabain.
What is the matter, Stronghammer? Growled Nargajvarg as he pushed his way over to Roran.
Roran glanced up at the heavy-headed Kull. I'm not sure. Galbatorix. He forgot whatever else he was going to say when a horn sounded among the buildings ahead of them. It blared for the better part of a minute, a low, ominous tone that caused the Varden to pause and look around with concern. Roran's heart sank. This is it, he said to Albrecht. Turning, he waved his hammer, motioning toward the side of the street.
Move over,
he bellowed. "Get between the buildings and take cover!" It took his battalion longer to extricate itself from the column of warriors than it had to join it. Frustrated, Roran continued shouting, trying to get them to move faster. "Quickly, you sorry dogs! Quickly!" The horn sounded again, and Jormungandr finally called a halt to the army. By then, Roran's warriors were safely wedged into three streets, where they stood clustered behind buildings, waiting for his orders. He stood by the side of a house, along with Garjvag and Horst, peering around the corner as he tried to see what was happening. Once more, the horn sounded, and then the tramp of many feet echoed through Urabane. Dread crawled through Roran as he saw rank after rank of soldiers march into the streets leading from the citadel, the rows of men brisk and orderly, their faces devoid of even the slightest hint of fear. At their head rode a squat, broad-shouldered man upon a grey charger. He wore a gleaming breastplate that bulged over a foot outward as if to accommodate a large belly. In his left hand he carried a shield painted with the device of a crumbling tower upon a bare stone peak. In his right hand he carried a spiked mace that most men would have found difficult to lift, but that he swung back and forth with ease. Roran wet his lips. He guessed that the man was none other than Lord Bast, and if even half the things he had heard about the man were true, then Bast would never ride straight at an opposing force unless he was utterly certain of destroying it. Roran had seen enough. Pushing himself off the corner of the building, he said, "We're not going to wait. Tell the others to follow us."
"You mean to run away, Strong Armor?" rumbled Nargajvag.
"No," said Roran. "I mean to attack from the side. Only a fool would attack an army like that head on. Now go!" He gave the Urgal a shove, then hurried down the cross street to take his position at the front of his warriors. "And only a fool would go head to head with the man Galbatorix has chosen to lead his forces." As they made their way between the densely packed buildings, Roran heard the soldiers start to chant, "Lord Bast! Lord Bast! Lord Bast!" And they stamped the ground with their hobnail boots and banged their swords against their shields. "Better and better," Roran thought, wishing he were anywhere but there. Then the Varden shouted in return, the air filled with cries of "Aragorn! And the riders!" And then the city rang with the sounds of clashing metal and the screams of wounded men. When his battalion was level with what Roran guessed was the midpoint of the Empire's army, he had them turn and start in the direction of their enemies. "Stay together," he ordered. "Form a wall with your shields, and whatever you do, make sure you protect the spellcasters." They soon spotted the soldiers in the street, spearmen mostly, pressed close against one another as they shuffled toward the front of the battle. Nargajvog let out a ferocious bellow, as did Roran and the other warriors in the battalion, and they charged toward the ranks of men. The soldiers shouted with alarm, and panic spread among them as they scrambled backward, trampling their own kind as they tried to find room to fight. Howling, Roran fell upon the first row of men. Blood sprayed around him as he swung his hammer and felt metal and bone give way. The soldiers were so tightly packed that they were nearly helpless. He killed four of them before even one managed to swing a sword at him, which he blocked with his shield. By the edge of the street, Nargajvag knocked down six men with a single blow of his club. The soldiers started to climb back to their feet, ignoring injuries that would have crippled them had they been able to feel pain, and Garjvag struck again, pounding them to a pulp. Roran was aware of nothing but the men in front of him, the weight of his hammer in his hand, and the slipperiness of the blood-coated cobblestones under his feet. He broke and he battered, he ducked and he shoved, he growled and he shouted, and he killed and he killed and he killed. Until to his surprise, he swung his hammer and found nothing but empty air before him. His weapon bounced against the ground, striking sparks from the cobblestones, and a painful jolt ran up his arm. Roran shook his head, his battle rage clearing. He had fought his way completely through the mass of soldiers. Spinning around, he saw that most of his warriors were still engaged with soldiers to his right and left. Loosing another howl, he dove back into the fray. Three soldiers closed in on him, two with spears, one with a sword. Roran lunged at the man with the sword, but his foot slipped beneath him as he stepped on something soft and wet. Even as he fell, he swung his hammer at the ankles of the nearest man. The soldier danced back and was about to bring his sword down on Roran, when an elf leaped forward and with two quick strokes beheaded all three soldiers. It was the same elf woman he had spoken to outside the city walls, only now splattered with stripes of gore. Before he could thank her, she darted past, her sword a blur as she cut down more of the soldiers. After watching them in action, Roran decided that each elf was worth at least 5 men, not even counting their ability to cast spells. As for the Urgles, he just did his best to stay out of their way, especially the Cull. They seemed to make little distinction between friend and foe once roused, and the Cull was so big it was easy for them to kill someone without meaning to. He saw one of them crush a soldier between his leg and the side of a building and not even notice. Another time he saw a Cull behead a soldier with an inadvertent swipe of a shield while turning about. The fighting continued for another few minutes, whereupon the only soldiers remaining in the area were dead soldiers. Wiping the sweat from his brow, Roran glanced up and down the street. Farther into the city, he saw remnants of the force they had destroyed disappearing between the houses as the men ran to join another part of Galbatorix's army. He considered pursuing them, but the main battle lay closer to the edge of the city, and he wanted to fall upon the rear of the attacking soldiers and disrupt their lines. "This way!" he shouted, raising his hammer and starting down the street. An arrow buried itself in the edge of his shield, and he looked up to see the silhouette of a man sliding below the peak of a nearby roof. When Roran emerged from between the close-set buildings into the open area before the remnants of Urabane's front gate, he found a scene of such confusion that he hesitated, unsure of what to do. The two armies had mingled together until it was impossible to determine lines or ranks, or even where the front of the battle was. The crimson tunics of the soldiers were scattered throughout the square, sometimes singly, sometimes in large clusters, and the fighting had spilled into all of the nearby streets, the armies spreading outward like a stain. Among the combatants Roran expected to see, he also spotted scores of cats, ordinary cats, not werecats, attacking the soldiers, as savage and frightening a sight as he had ever beheld. The cats, he knew, followed the direction of the werecats. And in the centre of the square, sitting upon his grey charger, was Lord Bast, his large round breastplate gleaming with the light of the fires burning in nearby houses. He swung his mace again and again, faster than any human ought to have been able to, and with every blow he slew at least one of the Varden. Arrows fired at him vanished in puffs of sickly orange flame, swords and spears bounced off him as if he were made of stone, and even the strength of a charging Cull was not enough to knock him off his steed. Roran watched with astonishment as with a casual swipe of his mace, the armor-clad man brained an attacking Cull, breaking his horns and skull as easily as an eggshell. Roran frowned. How can he be so strong and fast? Magic was the obvious answer, but that magic had to have a source. There were no gems upon Bast's mace or armor, nor could Roran believe that Galbatorix would be feeding energy to Bast from a distance. Roran remembered his conversation with Aragorn the night before they rescued Katrina from Hellgrind. Aragorn had told him that it was basically impossible to alter a human's body to have the speed and strength of an elf, even if the human was a rider, which made what the dragons had done to Aragorn during the Blood Oath celebration all the more amazing. It seemed unlikely that Galbatorix could have managed a similar transformation with Bast, which again made Roran wonder, where was the source of Bast's unnatural might? Bast pulled on the reins of his steed, turning the horse around. The light moving across the surface of his swollen breastplate caught Roran's attention. Roran's mouth went dry, and he felt a sense of despair. From what he knew, Bast was not the sort of man to have a belly. He would not let himself go soft, nor would Galbatorix have chosen such a man to defend Urabane. The only explanation that made sense, then, was that Bast had an Eldunari strapped to his body underneath his oddly shaped breastplate. Then the street shook and split, and a dark crevice appeared beneath Bast and his charger. The hole would have swallowed them both, with room to spare, but the horse remained standing upon thin air, as if its hooves were still planted firmly upon the ground. A wreath of different colours flickered around Bast like a nimbus of tattered rainbows. Alternating waves of heat and cold emanated from his location, and Roran saw tendrils of ice crawling up from the ground, seeking to wrap themselves around the horse's legs and hold them in place. But the ice could not grip the horse, nor did any of the magic seem to have an effect on either the man or the animal. Bast pulled on the reins again, then spurred his horse toward a group of elves who stood beside a nearby house, chanting in the ancient language. It was they, Roran assumed, who had been casting the spells against Bast. Lifting his mace above his head, Bast charged into the midst of the elves. They scattered, seeking to defend themselves, but to no avail, for Bast split their shields and broke their swords. And when he struck, the mace crushed the elves as if their bones were as thin and hollow as those of birds. "Why didn't their wards protect them?" Roran wondered. "Why can't they stop him with their minds? He's only one man, and there's only one Eldunari with him." A few yards away, a large round stone crashed into the sea of struggling bodies, leaving behind a bright red smear, and bounced into the front of a building, where it shattered the statues above the doorframe. Roran ducked and cursed as he looked for where the stone had come from. Halfway across the city, he saw that Galbatorix's soldiers had retaken the catapults and other war machines mounted on the curtain wall. "They're firing into their own city," he thought. "They're firing at their own men." With a growl of disgust, he turned away from the square so that he was facing the interior of the city. "We can't help here," he shouted to the battalion. "Leave Bast to the others. Take the street over there." He pointed to his left. "We'll fight our way to the wall and make our stand there." If the warriors responded, he did not hear, for he was already moving. Behind him, another stone crashed into the fighting armies, causing even more screams of pain. The street Roran had chosen was full of soldiers, as well as a few elves and weercats, who were clumped together by the front door of a hatter's shop, hard-pressed to fend off the large number of enemies around them. The elves shouted something, and a dozen soldiers fell to the ground, but the rest remained standing. Diving into the midst of the soldiers, Roran again lost himself in the red-tinged haze of battle. He leaped over one of the fallen soldiers and brought his hammer down on the helm of a man with his back turned. Confident that the man was dead, Roran used his shield to shove the next soldier back, and then jabbed with the end of his hammer at the man's throat, crushing it. Next to him, Delwyn caught a spear in his shoulder and went down on one knee with a cry of pain. Swinging his hammer even faster than normal, Roran drove back the spearman, while Delwyn pulled the weapon out and got back to his feet. "Fall back," Roran told him. Delwyn shook his head, teeth bared. "No! Fall back, blast you! That's an order!" Delwyn cursed, but he obeyed, and Horst took his place. The smith, Roran noticed, was bleeding from cuts on his arms and legs, but they did not seem to interfere with his ability to move. Evading a sword thrust, Roran took a step forward. He seemed to hear a faint rushing sound behind him, and then a thunderclap went off in his ears, and the earth spun around him, and everything went black. He woke with a throbbing head. Above, he saw the sky, bright now with the light from the rising sun, and the dark underside of the crevice-lined overhang. Groaning with pain, he pushed himself upright. He was lying at the base of the city's outer wall, next to the bloody fragments of a stone from a catapult. His shield was missing, as was his hammer, which concerned him in a befuddled sort of way. Even as he tried to regain his bearings, a group of 5 soldiers rushed at him, and one of the men stabbed him in the chest with a spear. The point of the weapon drove him back against the wall, but it did not pierce his skin. "Grab him!" shouted the soldiers, and Roran felt hands take hold of his arms and legs. He thrashed, trying to wrench free, but he was still weak and disoriented, and there were too many soldiers for him to overpower. The soldiers struck at him again and again, and he felt his strength fading as his wards shielded him from the blows. The world grew grey, and he was about to lose consciousness again, when the blade of a sword sprouted from the mouth of one of the soldiers. The soldiers dropped him, and Roran saw a dark-haired woman whirling among them, swinging her sword with the practiced ease of a seasoned warrior. Within seconds, she killed the 5 men, although one of them managed to give her a shallow cut along her left thigh. Afterward, she offered him her hand and said, "Stronghammer." As he grasped her forearm, he saw that her wrist, where her worn bracer did not cover it, was layered with scars, as if she had been burned or whipped nearly to the bone. Behind the woman stood a pale-faced teenage girl, clad in a piecemeal collection of armor, and also a boy, who looked a year or 2 younger than the girl. "Who are you?" he asked, standing. The woman's face was striking, broad and strong-boned, with the bronzed, weather-beaten look of one who had spent most of her life outdoors. "A passing stranger," she said. Bending at the knees, she picked up one of the soldier's spears and handed it to him. "My thanks," she nodded, and then she and her young companions trotted off among the buildings, heading farther into the city. Roran stared after them for a half-second, wondering, then shook himself and hurried back along the street to rejoin his battalion. The warriors greeted him with shouts of astonishment and, heartened, attacked the soldiers with renewed vigour. However, as Roran took his place along with the other men from Carvajal, he discovered that the stone that had struck him had also killed Delwyn. His sorrow quickly turned to rage, and he fought with even greater ferocity than before, determined to help end the battle as soon as possible. The Name of All Names. Afraid but determined, Aragorn strode forward with Arya, Elva, and Saphira toward the dais where Galbatorix sat relaxed upon his throne. It was a long walk, long enough that Aragorn had time to consider a number of strategies, most of which he discarded as impractical. He knew that strength alone would not be enough to defeat the king. It would require cunning as well, and that was the one thing he felt he most lacked. Still, they had no choice now but to confront Galbatorix. The 2 rows of lanterns that led to the dais were wide enough apart that the 4 of them were able to walk side by side. For that, Aragorn was glad, as it meant Saphira would be able to fight next to them if need be. As they approached the throne, Aragorn continued to study the chamber around them. It was, he thought, a strange room for a king to receive guests in. Aside from the bright path that lay before them, most of the space was hidden within impenetrable gloom, even more so than the halls of the dwarfs beneath Trondheim and Farthendur, and the air contained a dry, musky scent that seemed familiar, even though he could not place it. "Where is Shrukan?" he said in an undertone. Saphira sniffed.
"I can smell him, but I don't hear him."
Elva frowned.
"Nor can I feel him."
When they were perhaps 30 feet from the dais, they halted. Behind the throne hung thick black curtains made of velvety material, which stretched up toward the ceiling. A shadow lay over Galbatorix, concealing his features. Then he leaned forward into the light, and Aragorn saw his face. It was long and lean, with a deep brow and a blade-like nose. His eyes were hard as stones, and they showed little white around the irises. His mouth was thin and wide, with a slight downturn at the corners, and he had a close-cropped beard and moustache, which, like his clothes, were black as pitch. In age he appeared to be in his fourth decade, still at the height of his strength, yet near the beginning of his decline. There were lines on his brow and on either side of his nose, and his tanned skin had a thin look to it, as if he had eaten nothing but rabbit meat and turnips through the winter. His shoulders were broad and well-built, and his waist trim. Upon his head was a crown of reddish gold, set with all manner of jewels. The crown appeared old, older even than the hall, and Aragorn wondered if perhaps it had once belonged to King Palancar, many hundreds of years ago. On Galbatorix's lap rested his sword. It was a rider's sword, that much was obvious, but Aragorn had never seen it like before. The blade, hilt, and crossguard were stark white, while the gem within the pommel was as clear as a mountain spring. Altogether, there was something about the weapon that Aragorn found unsettling. Its colour, or rather its lack of colour, reminded him of a sun-bleached bone. It was the colour of death, not life, and it seemed far more dangerous than any shade of black, be it ever so dark. Galbatorix examined them each in turn with his sharp, unblinking gaze.
"So you have come to kill me," he said. "Well then, shall we begin?"
He lifted his sword and spread his arms to either side in a welcoming gesture. Aragorn widened his stance and raised his sword and shield. The king's invitation unsettled him. "He's playing with us." Still keeping hold of the Dauthdert, Elva stepped forward and began to speak. However, no sound came from her mouth, and she looked at Aragorn with an expression of alarm. Aragorn tried to touch her mind with his own, but he could feel nothing of her thoughts. It was as if she were no longer in the room with them. Galbatorix laughed, then returned his sword to his lap and leaned back in his throne.
"Did you truly believe that I was ignorant of your ability, child? Did you really think you could render me helpless with such a petty, transparent trick? Oh, I have no doubt your words could harm me, but only if I can hear them."
His bloodless lips curved in a cruel, humorless smile.
"Such folly. This is the extent of your plan? A girl who cannot speak unless I grant her leave? A spear more suited for hanging on a wall than carrying into battle? And a collection of Eldunari half out of their minds with age? Tut, tut. I had thought better of you, Arya, and you, Gleda. But then I suppose your emotions have clouded your reason, since I used Murtagh to slay Oromis."
To Aragorn, Saphira, and Arya, Gleda said,
"Kill him."
The golden dragon felt perfectly calm, but his very serenity betrayed an anger that surpassed all other emotions. Aragorn exchanged a quick glance with Arya and Saphira, and then the three of them started toward the dais, even as Gleda, Umaroth, and the other Eldunari attacked Galbatorix's mind. Before Aragorn managed to take more than a few steps, the king rose up from his velvet seat and shouted a word. The word reverberated within Aragorn's mind, and every part of his being seemed to thrum in response, as if he were an instrument upon which a bard had struck a chord. Despite the intensity of his response, Aragorn was unable to remember the word. It faded from his mind, leaving behind only the knowledge of its existence and how it had affected him. Galbatorix uttered other words after the first, but none seemed to have the same power, and Aragorn was too dazed to comprehend their meaning. As the last phrase left the king's lips, a force gripped Aragorn, stopping him in mid-stride. The jolt shook a yelp of surprise from him. He tried to move, but his body might as well have been encased in stone. All he could do was breathe, look, and as he had already discovered, speak. He did not understand. His wards should have protected him from the king's magic. That they did not left him feeling as if he were teetering on the edge of a vast abyss. Next to him, Sephira, Arya, and Elva appeared likewise immobilized. Enraged by how easily the king had caught them, Aragorn joined his mind with the Eldunari as they battered at Galbatorix's consciousness. He felt a vast number of minds opposing them, dragons all, who crooned and babbled and shrieked in a mad, disjointed chorus that contained such pain and sorrow. Aragorn wanted to pull himself away, lest they drag him down into their insanity. They were strong, too, as if most of them had been Glaider's size or larger. The opposing dragons made it impossible to attack Galbatorix directly. Every time Aragorn thought he felt the touch of the king's thoughts, one of the enslaved dragons would throw itself at Aragorn's mind and, gibbering all the while, force him to retreat. Fighting the dragons was difficult on account of their wild and incoherent thoughts. Subduing any one of them was like trying to hold down a rabid wolf. And there were so many of them, far more than the riders had hidden in the Vault of Souls. Before either side could gain the advantage, Galbatorix, who seemed entirely unaffected by the invisible struggle, said,
"Come out, my dears, and meet our guests."
A boy and a girl emerged from behind the throne and came to stand by the king's right hand. The girl looked about 6, the boy perhaps 8 or 9. They shared a close resemblance, and Aragorn guessed they were brother and sister. Both were dressed in their night garments. The girl clung to the boy's arm and half hid behind him, while the boy appeared frightened but determined. Even as he struggled against Galbatorix's Eldunari, Aragorn could feel the minds of the children, could feel their terror and confusion, and he knew they were real.
"Isn't she charming?" asked Galbatorix, lifting the girl's chin with one long finger. "Such large eyes and such pretty hair. And isn't he a handsome young lad?"
He put his hand on the boy's shoulder.
"Children, it is said, are a blessing to us all. I do not happen to share that belief. It has been my experience that children are every bit as cruel and vindictive as adults. They only lack the strength to subjugate others to their will. Perhaps you agree with me, perhaps you don't. Regardless, I know that you of the Varden pride yourselves on your virtue. You see yourselves as upholders of justice, defenders of the innocent, as if any are truly innocent, and as noble warriors fighting to right an ancient wrong. Very well, then, let us test your convictions and see if you are what you claim to be. Unless you stop your attack, I shall kill these two." He shook the boy's shoulder. "And I shall kill them if you dare attack me again. In fact, if you displease me excessively, I shall kill them anyway. So I advise you to be courteous." The boy and the girl appeared sick at his words, but they made no attempt to flee. Aragorn looked over at Arya, and he saw his despair mirrored in her eyes.
"Umaroth!"
they cried out.
"No,"
growled the white dragon, even as he wrestled with the mind of another Eldunari.
"You have to stop,"
said Arya.
"No."
"He'll kill them,"
said Aragorn.
"No, we will not give up, not now."
"Enough,"
roared Glaider.
"There are hatchlings in danger.
And more hatchlings will be in danger if we do not kill the Eggbreaker."
"Yes, but now is the wrong time to try,"
said Arya.
"Wait a little while, and perhaps we can find a way to attack him without risking the lives of the children."
"And if not?"
asked Umaroth. Neither Aragorn nor Arya could bring themselves to answer.
"Then we will do what we must,"
said Saphira. Aragorn hated it, but he knew she was right. They could not place the two children before the whole of Alagaesia. If possible, they would save the boy and the girl, but if not, then they would still attack. They had no other choice. As Umaroth and the Eldunari he spoke for grudgingly subsided, Galbatorix smiled.
There, that's better. Now we may speak as civilized beings, without worrying about who is trying to kill whom.
He patted the boy on the head, and then pointed toward the steps of the dais.
Sit.
Without arguing, the two children settled on the lowest step, as far from the king as they could get. Then Galbatorix motioned and said,
Couster.
And Aragorn slid forward until he was standing at the base of the dais, as did Arya, Elva, and Saphira. Aragorn continued to be bewildered that their wards were not protecting them. He thought of the word, whatever it might have been, and a horrible suspicion began to take root within him. Hopelessness quickly followed. For all their plans, for all their talking and worrying and suffering, for all their sacrifices, Galbatorix had captured them as easily as he might a litter of newborn kittens. And if Aragorn's suspicion was true, the king was even more formidable than they had suspected. Still, they were not entirely helpless. Their minds were, for the moment, their own, and so far as he could tell, they could still use magic, one way or another. Galbatorix's gaze settled upon Aragorn.
So you are the one who has given me so much trouble, Aragorn, son of Morzan. You and I should have met long ago. Had your mother not been so foolish as to hide you in Carvajal, you would have grown up here in Urubain, as a child of the nobility, with all the riches and responsibilities that entails, instead of whiling away your days grubbing in the dirt.
Be that as it may, you are here now, and those things shall at last be yours. They are your birthright, your inheritance, and I shall see to it that you receive them. He seemed to study Aragorn with greater intensity, and then he said,
You look more like your mother than your father. With Murtagh, the opposite holds true. Still, it matters little. Whichever one you resemble most, it is only right that you and your brother should serve me, even as did your parents.
Never, said Aragorn with a clenched jaw. A thin smile appeared on the king's face.
Never. We shall see.
His gaze shifted.
And you, Saphira, of all my guests today, I am gladdest to see you. You have grown to a fine adulthood. Do you remember this place? Do you remember the sound of my voice? I spent many a night talking to you and the other eggs in my charge, during the years when I was securing my rule over the Empire.
I remember a little, said Saphira.
And Aragorn relayed her words to the king. She did not want to communicate directly with the king, nor would the king have allowed it. Keeping their minds separate was the best way to protect themselves when not in open conflict. Galbatorix nodded.
And I am sure you will remember more the longer you stay within these walls. You may not have been fully aware of it at the time, but you spent most of your life in a room not far from here. This is your home, Saphira. It is where you belong, and it is where you will build your nest and lay your eggs.
Saphira's eyes narrowed, and Aragorn felt a strange yearning from her, mixed with a burning hatred. The king moved on.
Arya Drotningu. Fate, it seems, has a sense of humour, for here you are, even as I ordered you to be brought so long ago. Your path was a roundabout one, but still you have come, and of your own accord. I find that rather amusing, don't you?
Arya pressed her lips together and refused to answer. Galbatorix chuckled. I admit you have been a thorn in my side for quite some time now. You've not caused as much mischief as that bumbling meddler Brom, but neither have you been idle. One might even say that this whole situation is your fault, as it was you who sent Saphira's egg to Aragorn. However, I hold no enmity toward you. If not for you, Saphira might not have hatched, and I might never have been able to flush the last of my enemies from hiding. For that, I thank you. And then there is you, Elva, the girl with the sigil of a rider upon her brow, dragon-marked and blessed with the wherewithal to perceive all that pains a person and all that will pain them. How you must have suffered these past months! How you must despise those around you for their weaknesses, even as you are forced to share in their misery! The Varden have used you poorly. Today I shall end the battles that have so tormented you, and you shall no longer have to endure the mistakes and misfortunes of others. That I promise. On occasion I may have need of your skill, but in the main you may live as you please, and peace shall be yours. Elva frowned, but it was obvious that the king's offer tempted her. Listening to Galbatorix, Aragorn realized, could be as dangerous as listening to Elva herself. Galbatorix paused and fingered the wire-wrapped hilt of his sword, while he regarded them with a hooded gaze. Then he looked past them, toward the point in the air where the Eldunari floated hidden from sight, and his mood seemed to darken. "Convey my words to Umaroth as I speak them," he said. "Umaroth, we are ill met once again. I thought I killed you on Vroengard." Umaroth responded, and Aragorn began to relay his words. "He says that you killed only his body," Arya finished. "That much is obvious," said Galbatorix. "Where did the riders hide you and those with you? On Vroengard, or was it elsewhere? My servants and I searched the ruins of Doru Areba most closely." Aragorn hesitated to deliver the dragon's answer, as it was sure to displease the king, but he could think of no other option. "He says that he will never share that information with you of his own free will." Galbatorix's eyebrows met above his nose. "Does he now? Well, he'll tell me soon enough, whether he wishes to or not." The king tapped the pommel of his glaringly white sword. "I took this blade from his rider, you know, when I killed him, when I killed Vrail, in the watchtower that overlooks Palancar Valley. Vrail had his own name for this sword. He called it Islinger, Lightbringer. I thought Vranger was more appropriate." Vranger meant awry, and Aragorn agreed that it fitted the sword better. A dull boom sounded behind them, and Galbatorix smiled again. "Ah, good. Murtagh and Thorn shall be joining us shortly, and then we can begin properly." Another sound filled the chamber, then a great gusting noise that seemed to come from several directions at once. Galbatorix glanced over his shoulder and said, "It was inconsiderate of you to attack so early in the morning. I was already awake. I rise well before dawn. But you woke Shrewkin. He gets rather irritated when he's tired, and when he's irritated, he tends to eat people. My guards learned long ago not to disturb him when he's resting. You would have done well to follow their example." As Galbatorix spoke, the curtains behind his throne shifted and rose toward the ceiling. With a sense of shock, Aragorn realized that they were actually Shrewkin's wings. The black dragon lay curled on the floor with his head close to the throne, the bulk of his massive body forming a wall too steep and too high for any to climb without magic. His scales had not the radiance of Saphira's or Thorn's, but rather sparkled with a dark, liquid brilliance. Their inky colour made them almost opaque, which gave them an appearance of strength and solidity that Aragorn had not seen in a dragon's scales before. It was as if Shrukan were plated with stone or metal, not gems. The dragon was enormous. Aragorn at first had difficulty comprehending that the entire shape before them was a single living creature. He saw part of Shrukan's corded neck and thought he was seeing the main part of the dragon's body. He saw the side of one of Shrukan's hind feet and mistook it for a shin. A fold of a wing was an entire wing in his mind. Only when he looked up and found the spikes atop the dragon's spine did Aragorn grasp the full extent of Shrukan's size. Each spike was as wide as the trunk of an ancient oak tree. The scales surrounding them were a foot thick, if not more. Then Shrukan opened an eye and looked down at them. His iris was a pale blue-white, the colour of a high mountain glacier, and it appeared startlingly bright amid the black of his scales. The dragon's huge, slitted orb darted back and forth as he studied their faces. His gaze seemed to contain nothing but fury and madness, and Aragorn felt certain that Shrukan would kill them in an instant if Galbatorix allowed it. The stare of the enormous eye, especially when it held such evident malice, made Aragorn want to run and hide in a burrow deep, deep underground. It was, he imagined, very much how a rabbit must feel when confronted by a large, toothy creature. Beside him, Saphira growled, and the scales along her back rippled and lifted like hackles. In response, jets of fire appeared in the yawning pits of Shrukan's nostrils, and then he growled as well, drowning out Saphira and filling the chamber with a rumble like that of a rock slide. On the dais, the two children squeaked and curled into balls, tucking their heads between their knees.
"Peace, Shrukan," said Galbatorix,
and the black dragon grew silent again. His eyelid descended, but it did not close completely. The dragon continued to watch them through a gap a few inches wide, as if waiting for the right moment to pounce.
"He does not like you," said Galbatorix. "But then he does not like anyone, do you now, Shrukan?"
The dragon snorted, and the smell of smoke tinged the air. Hopelessness again overwhelmed Aragorn. Shrukan could kill Saphira with a bat of his paw, and as large as the chamber was, it was still too small for Saphira to evade the great black dragon for long. His hopelessness turned to frustrated rage, and he wrenched at his invisible bonds. "How is it you can do this?" he shouted, straining every muscle in his body.
"I would like to know that as well," said Arya.
Galbatorix's eyes seemed to gleam beneath the dark eaves of his brow.
"Can you not guess, Elfling?"
"I would prefer an answer to a guess," she replied.
"Very well. But first you must do something, so that you may know that what I say is indeed the truth. You must try to cast a spell, both of you, and then I shall tell you."
When neither Aragorn nor Arya made to speak, the king gestured with his hand.
"Go on. I promise that I will not punish you for it. Now try. I insist."
Arya went first. "Throutha," she said, her voice hard and low. She was, Aragorn guessed, trying to send the Dauthdert flying toward Galbatorix. The weapon, however, remained fixed to her hand. Then Aragorn spoke.
"Brisingr!"
He thought that perhaps his bond with his sword would allow him to use magic where Arya could not. But to his disappointment, the blade remained as it was, glittering dimly in the dull light of the lanterns. Galbatorix's gaze grew more intense.
"The answer must be obvious to you now, Elfling. It has taken me most of the past century, but at long last I have found what I was searching for.
a means of governing the spellcasters of Alagazia. The search was not easy. Most men would have given up in frustration, or if they had the required patience, fear. But not I. I persisted, and through my study, I discovered what I had for so long desired, a tablet written in another land and another age, by hands that were neither elf nor dwarf nor human nor Urgle. And upon that tablet there was scribed a certain word, a name that magicians throughout the ages have hunted for with nothing but bitter disappointment as their reward. Galbatorix lifted a finger. The name of all names. The name of the ancient language. Aragorn bit back a curse. He had been right. That's what the Razak was trying to tell me, he thought, remembering what one of the insect-like monsters had said to him in Helgrind. He has almost found the name, the true name. As disheartening as Galbatorix's revelation was, Aragorn clung to the knowledge that the name could not stop him or Arya, or Saphira for that matter, from using magic without the ancient language. Not that it would do much good. The king's wards were sure to protect him and Shrukan from any spells they might cast. Still, if the king did not know that it was possible to use magic without the ancient language, or even if he did, but he believed that they did not, then they might be able to surprise him and maybe distract him for a moment, although Aragorn was not sure how that might help. Galbatorix continued, "With this word, I can reshape spells as easily as another magician might command the elements. All spells shall be subject to me, but I am subject to none, except for those of my choosing." Perhaps he doesn't know, Aragorn thought, a spark of determination kindling in his heart. I shall use the name of names to bring every magician in Alagazia to heel, and no one shall cast a spell but with my blessing, not even the elves. At this very moment, the magicians of your army are discovering the truth of this. Once they venture a certain distance into Urbane, past the front gate, their spells cease to work as they should. Some of their enchantments fail outright, while others twist and end up affecting your troops instead of mine. Galbatorix tilted his head, and his gaze grew distant, as if he were listening to someone whispering in his ear. It has caused much confusion among their ranks. Aragorn fought the urge to spit at the king. It doesn't matter, he growled. We'll still find a way to stop you. Galbatorix seemed grimly amused. Is that so? How? And why? Think what you are saying. You would stop the first opportunity that Alagazia has had for true peace in order to sate your overdeveloped sense of vengeance? You would allow magicians everywhere to continue to have their way, regardless of the harm they cause others. That seems far worse than anything I have done. But this is idle speculation. The finest warriors of the Riders could not defeat me, and you are far from their equal. You never had any hope of overthrowing me. None of you did. I killed Durza, and I killed the Razak, said Aragorn. Why not you? I am not as weak as those who serve me. You could not even trounce Murtagh, and he is but a shadow of a shadow. Your father Morzan was far more powerful than either of you, and even he could not withstand my might. Besides, said Galbatorix, as a cruel expression settled on his face, you are mistaken if you think you destroyed the Razak. The eggs in Dras Leona weren't the only ones I took from the Leatherblucker. I have others hidden elsewhere. Soon they shall hatch, and soon the Razak shall once more roam the earth to do my bidding. As for Durza, shades are easy to make, and they are often more trouble than they are worth. So you see, you have won nothing, boy. Nothing but false victories. Above all, Aragorn hated Galbatorix's smugness and his air of overwhelming superiority. He wanted to rage at the king and curse him with every oath he knew. But for the sake of the children's safety, he held his tongue. "Do you have any ideas?" he asked Saphira, Arya, and Gleda.
"No,"
said Saphira. The others remained silent. "Umaroth?"
"Only that we should attack while we still can."
A minute passed wherein no one spoke. Galbatorix leaned on one elbow and rested his chin on his fist while he continued to watch them. By his feet, the boy and the girl cried softly. Above, Shrukan's eye remained fixed on Aragorn and those with him, like a great ice-blue lantern. Then they heard the doors to the chamber open and close, and the sound of approaching footsteps. The footsteps of both a man and a dragon. Murtagh and Thorn soon appeared in their field of vision. They stopped next to Saphira, and Murtagh bowed. "Sir." The king motioned, and Murtagh and Thorn walked over to the right of the throne. As Murtagh took up his position, he gave Aragorn a look of disgust. Then he clasped his hands behind his back and stared toward the far end of the chamber, ignoring him.
"You took longer than I expected," said Galbatorix in a deceptively mild voice.
Without looking, Murtagh said, "The gate was more damaged than I originally thought, sir, and the spells you placed on it made it difficult to repair."
"Do you mean that it's my fault you are tardy?"
Murtagh's jaw tightened. "No, sir. I only mean to explain. Also, part of the hallway was rather messy, and that slowed us."
"I see. We shall speak of this later. But for now, there are other matters we must attend to. For one, it is time our guests meet the final member of our party. Moreover, it is high time we had some proper light in here."
And Galbatorix struck the flat of his blade against one arm of his throne, and in a deep voice he cried, "Nain!" At his command, hundreds of lanterns sprang to life along the walls of the chamber, bathing it with warm, candle-like illumination. The room was still dim about the corners, but for the first time, Aragorn could make out the details of their surroundings. Scores of pillars and doorways lined the walls, and all about were sculptures and paintings and gilt scrollwork. Gold and silver had been used with abundance, and Aragorn glimpsed the sparkle of many jewels. It was a staggering display of wealth, even when compared with the riches of Tronchim or Ellesmere. After a moment, he noticed something else. A block of grey stone, granite perhaps, 8 feet tall, which stood off to their right, beyond where the light had previously reached. And chained, standing to the block, was Nasuada, wearing a simple white tunic. She was watching them with wide-open eyes, though she could not speak, for a knotted cloth was tied over her mouth. She looked worn and tired, but otherwise healthy. Relief shot through Aragorn. He had not dared hope to find her alive. "Nasuada!" he shouted. "Are you all right?" She nodded. "Has he forced you to swear fealty to him?" She shook her head.
"Do you think I would let her tell you if I had?" asked Galbatorix.
As Aragorn looked back at the king, he saw Murtagh cast a quick, concerned glance toward Nasuada, and he wondered at its significance. "Well, have you?" Aragorn asked in a challenging tone.
"As it so happens, no. I decided to wait until I had gathered all of you together. Now that I have, none shall leave until you have pledged yourself in service to me. Nor shall you leave until I have learned the true name of each and every one of you. That is why you are here.
not to kill me, but to bow down before me and to finally put an end to this noisome rebellion. Saphira growled again, and Aragorn said, "We won't give in." Even to his own ears, his words seemed weak and toothless.
"Then they will die,"
Galbatorix replied, pointing at the two children.
"And in the end your defiance will change nothing."
"You do not seem to understand. You have already lost."
"Outside, the battle fares badly for your friends. Soon my men will force them to surrender, and this war will arrive at its destined conclusion. Fight if you wish. Deny what is before you if it comforts you. But nothing you do can change your fate, or that of Alagazia."
Aragorn refused to believe that he and Saphira would have to spend the rest of their lives answering to Galbatorix. Saphira felt the same, and her anger joined with his, burning away every last bit of his fear and caution. And he said, "Ve weonata ono vergari, eka theat otherum. We will kill you, I swear it." For a moment Galbatorix appeared aggravated. Then he spoke the word again, as well as other words in the ancient language besides, and the vow Aragorn had uttered seemed to lose all meaning. The words lay in his mind like a handful of dead leaves, devoid of any power to impel or inspire. The king's upper lip curved in a sneer. "Swear all the oaths you want. They shall not bind you. Not unless I allow them to." "I'll still kill you," Aragorn muttered. He understood that if he continued to resist, it might mean the lives of the two children. But Galbatorix had to be killed, and if the price of his death was the deaths of the boy and the girl, then that was a cost Aragorn was willing to accept. He knew he would hate himself for it. He knew that he would see the faces of the children in his dreams for the rest of his life. But if he did not challenge Galbatorix, then all would be lost.
"Do not hesitate," said Umaroth. "Now is the time to strike."
Aragorn raised his voice. "Why won't you fight me? Are you a coward? Or are you too weak to match yourself against me? Is that why you hide behind these children like a frightened old woman?"
"Aragorn," said Arya in a warning tone.
"I am not the only one who brought a child here today," replied the king, the lines on his face deepening.
"There is a difference. Elva agreed to come, but you didn't answer the question. Why won't you fight? Is it that you've spent so long sitting on your throne and eating sweets that you've forgotten how to swing a sword?"
"You would not want to fight me, youngling," growled the king.
"Prove it then. Release me and meet me in honest battle. Show that you are still a warrior to be reckoned with, or live with the knowledge that you are a snivelling coward who dares not face even a single opponent without the help of your Eldenari. You killed Vrail himself. Why should you fear me? Why should—"
"Enough," said Galbatorix.
A flush had crept into his hollow cheeks. Then, like Quicksilver, his mood changed, and he bared his teeth in a fearsome approximation of a smile. He rapped the arm of his seat with his knuckles.
"I did not gain this throne by accepting every challenge put to me, nor have I held it by meeting my foes in honest battle. What you have yet to learn, youngling, is that it does not matter how you achieve victory, only that you achieve it."
"You're wrong. It does matter," said Aragorn.
"I will remind you of that when you are sworn to me. However," Galbatorix tapped the pommel of his sword, "since you wish so badly to fight, I will grant your request."
The flare of hope that Aragorn felt vanished when Galbatorix added,
"But not with me, with Murtagh."
At those words, Murtagh flashed an angry look at Aragorn. The king stroked the fringe of his beard.
I would like to know once and for all which of you is the better warrior. You will fight as you are, without magic or Eldunari, until one of you is unable to continue. You may not kill each other, that I forbid. But short of death, I will allow most anything. It will be rather entertaining, I think, to watch brother fight brother.
No, said Aragorn, not brothers, half-brothers. Brom was my father, not Morzan.
For the first time, Galbatorix appeared surprised. Then one corner of his mouth twisted upward.
Of course, I should have seen it. The truth is in your face for any who know what to look for. This duel will be all the more fitting, then. The son of Brom pitted against the son of Morzan. Fate indeed has a sense of humor.
Murtagh also reacted with surprise. He controlled his face too well for Aragorn to determine whether the information pleased or upset him. But Aragorn knew that it had thrown him off balance. That had been his plan. If Murtagh was distracted, it would be that much easier for Aragorn to defeat him. And he did intend to defeat him, regardless of the blood they shared.
Letter, said Galbatorix, with a slight motion of his hand.
Aragorn staggered as the spell holding him vanished.
Then the king said, Ganga Apta,
and Arya, Elva, and Saphira slid backward, leaving a wide space between them and the dais. The king muttered a few other words, and most of the lanterns in the chamber dimmed, so that the area in front of the throne was the brightest spot in the room.
Come now, said Galbatorix to Murtagh. Join Aragorn, and let us see which of you is the more skilled.
Scowling, Murtagh walked to a spot several yards from where Aragorn stood. He drew Zarok. The blade of the crimson sword looked as if it were already coated in blood, then lifted his shield and settled into a crouch. After glancing at Saphira and Arya, Aragorn did the same.
Now fight, cried Galbatorix, and clapped his hands.
Sweating, Aragorn began to move toward Murtagh, even as Murtagh moved toward him.